shame and guilt. So, what do I do now?
You tell her, Mackenzie.
You face the fear of coming out of the dark and tell her, and ask for her forgiveness, and you let her forgiveness heal you. Ask her to pray for you, Mac. Take the risks of honesty. When you mess up again, ask for forgiveness again. It's a process, honey, and life is real enough without having to be obscured by lies. And remember, I am bigger than your lies. I can work beyond them, but that doesn't make them right and doesn't stop the damage they do or the hurt they cause others. What if she doesn't forgive me? Mac knew that this was indeed a very deep fear that he lived with. It felt safer to continue to throw new lies on the growing pile of old ones. Ah, that is the risk of faith, Mac. Faith does not grow in the house of certainty. I am not here to tell you that Nan will forgive you. Perhaps she won't or can't. But my life inside of you will appropriate risk and uncertainty to transform you by your own choices into a truth-teller. And that will be a miracle greater than raising the dead. Mac sat back and let her words sink in. Will you please forgive me?
Did that a long time ago, Mac.
If you don't believe me, ask Jesus. He was there. Mac took a sip of his coffee, surprised to find that it was still as hot as when he first sat down. But I've tried pretty hard to lock you out of my life. People are tenacious when it comes to the treasure of their imaginary independence. They hoard and hold their sickness with a firm grip. They find their identity and worth in their brokenness, and guard it with every ounce of strength they have. No wonder grace has such little attraction. In that sense, you've tried to lock the door of your heart from the inside. But I didn't succeed. That's because my love is a lot bigger than your stupidity. I used your choices to work perfectly into my purposes. There are many folk like you, Mackenzie, who end up locking themselves into a very small place with a monster that will ultimately betray them, that will not fill or deliver what they thought it would. Imprisoned with such a terror, they once again have the opportunity to return to me. The very treasure they trusted in will become their undoing. So you use pain to force people back to you? It was obvious Mac didn't approve. Papa leaned forward and gently touched Mac's hand. Honey, I also forgave you for even thinking I could be that way. I understand how difficult it is for you, so lost in your perceptions of reality, and yet so sure of your own judgments, to even begin to perceive, let alone imagine, who real love and goodness are. True love never forces. She squeezed his hand and sat back. But if I understand what you're saying, the consequences of our selfishness are part of the process that brings us to the end of our delusions and helps us find you. Is that why you don't stop every evil? Is that why you didn't warn me that Missy was in danger or help us find her? The accusing tone was no longer in Mac's voice. If only it were that simple, Mackenzie. Nobody knows what horrors I have saved the world from, 'cause people can't see what never happened. All evil flows from independence, and independence is your choice. If I were to simply revoke all the choices of independence, the world as you know it would cease to exist, and love would have no meaning. This world is not a playground where I keep all my children free from evil. Evil is the chaos of this age that you brought to me, but it will not have the final say. Now it touches everyone that I love, those who follow me and those who don't. If I take away the consequences of people's choices, I destroy the possibility of love. Love that is forced is no love at all. Mac rubbed his hands through his hair and sighed. It's just so hard to understand. Honey, let me tell you one of the reasons that it makes no sense to you. It's because you have such a small view of what it means to be human. You and this creation are incredible, whether you understand that or not. You are wonderful beyond imagination. Just because you make horrendous and destructive choices does not mean you deserve less respect for what you inherently are, the pinnacle of my creation and the center of my affection. But also, don't forget that in the midst of all your pain and heartache, you are surrounded by beauty, the wonder of creation, art, your music and culture, the sounds of laughter and love, of whispered hopes and celebrations of new life and transformation, of reconciliation and forgiveness. These also are the results of your choices, and every choice matters, even the hidden ones. So whose choices should we countermand, Mackenzie? Perhaps I should never have created. Perhaps Adam should have been stopped before he chose independence. What about your choice to have another daughter, or your father's choice to beat his son? You demand your independence, but then complain that I actually love you enough to give it to you. I've heard that before. Papa smiled back and reached for a piece of pastry. I told you Sophia got to you. Mackenzie, my purposes are not for my comfort or yours. My purposes are always and only an expression of love. I purpose to work life out of death, to bring freedom out of brokenness and turn darkness into light. What you see as chaos, I see as fractal. All things must unfold, even though it puts all those I love in the midst of a world of horrible tragedies, even the one closest to me. You're talking about Jesus, aren't you? Yep. I love that boy. Papa looked away and shook her head. Everything's about him, you know. One day you folk will understand what he gave up. There are just no words. Mac could feel his own emotions welling up. Something touched him deeply as he watched Papa talk about her son. He hesitated to ask, but finally broke into the silence. Papa, can you help me understand something? What exactly did Jesus accomplish by dying? She was still looking out into the forest. Oh, nothing much. Just the substance of everything that love purposed from before the foundations of creation, Papa stated matter-of-factly, then turned and smiled. Wow, that's a pretty broad brush. Could you bring it down a few notches? Mac thought he asked rather boldly after the words had left his mouth. Papa, instead of being upset, beamed at him. My, but aren't you getting uppity at all? Give a man an inch, and he thinks he's a ruler. He returned the grin, but his mouth was full, and he didn't say anything. Like I said, everything is about him. Creation and history are all about Jesus. He is the very center of our purpose, and in him we are now fully human, so our purpose and your destiny are forever linked. You might say that we put all our eggs in the one human basket. There is no plan B. Seems pretty risky. Maybe for you, but not for me. There's never been a question that what I wanted from the beginning I will get. Papa sat forward and crossed her arms on the table. Honey, you asked me what Jesus accomplished on the cross, so now listen to me carefully. Through his death and resurrection, I am now fully reconciled to the world. The whole world? You mean those who believe in you, right? The whole world, Mac. All I am telling you is that reconciliation is a two-way street, and I have done my part totally, completely, finally. It is not the nature of love to force a relationship, but it is the nature of love to open the way. At that, Papa stood up and gathered the dishes to take into the kitchen. Mac shook his head and looked up. So, I don't really understand reconciliation, and I'm really scared of emotions. Is that about it? Papa didn't answer immediately, but shook her head as she turned and walked away in the direction of the kitchen. Mac overheard her grunt and mutter, as if only to herself, "Man, such idiots sometimes." Mac couldn't believe it. "Did I hear God call me an idiot?" He saw her shrug before disappearing around the corner, and then he heard her yell back in his direction, "If the shoe fits, honey."
Yes, sir, if the shoe fits.
Mac laughed and sat back. He felt finished. His brain tank was more than full, as was his stomach. He carried the rest of the dishes to the kitchen and placed the stack on the counter, kissed Papa on the cheek, and headed for the back door. Verbs and Other Freedoms. God is a verb. Buckminster Fuller. Mac stepped outside into the mid-afternoon sun. He felt an odd mixture of being wrung out like a rag and yet exhilaratingly alive. What an incredible day this had been, and it was barely half over. For a moment, he stood undecided before wandering down to the lake. When he saw the canoes tied up at the dock, he knew it would probably forever be bittersweet. But the thought of taking one out on the lake energized him for the first time in years. Untying the last one at the end of the dock, he gingerly slid into it and began paddling toward the other side. For the next couple of hours, he circled the lake, exploring its nooks and crannies. He found two rivers and a couple of creeks that either fed from above or emptied down toward the lower basins, and he discovered a perfect spot to drift and watch the waterfall. Alpine flowers blossomed everywhere, adding splashes of color to the landscape. This was the most calm and consistent sense of peace that Mac had felt in ages, if ever. He even sang a few songs, a couple old hymns and a couple old folk songs, just because he wanted to. Singing was also something he had not done in a long time. Reaching back into the distant past, he began to voice the silly little song he used to sing to Kate. "K-k-k-Katie, a beautiful Katie, you're the only one that I adore." He shook his head as he thought about his daughter, so tough, but so fragile. He wondered how he might find a way to reach her heart. He was no longer surprised how easily tears could come to his eyes. At one point he turned to watch eddies and whirls made by the oar blade and stern, and when he turned back, Sarayu was sitting in the prow, looking at him. Her sudden presence made him jump.
"Jeez, you startled me."
"I am sorry, Mackenzie, but supper is almost ready, and it is time to invite you to make your way back to the shack. Have you been with me the entire time?"
"Of course. I am always with you."
"Then how come I didn't know it? Lately I've been able to tell when you're around." "For you to know or not has nothing at all to do with whether I'm actually here or not. I am always with you. Sometimes I want you to be aware in a special way, more intentional." Mac nodded that he understood and turned the canoe toward the distant shore and the shack. He now distinctly felt her presence in the tingle down his spine. They both smiled simultaneously. "Will I always be able to see you or hear you like I do now, even if I'm back home?"
"Mackenzie, you can always talk to me, and I will always be with you, whether you sense my presence or not."
"I know that now, but how will I hear you?"
"You will learn to hear my thoughts in yours, Mackenzie."
"Will it be clear? What if I confuse you with another voice? What if I make mistakes?" Saryu's laugh made the sound like tumbling water, only set to music.
"Of course you will make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. But you will begin to better recognize my voice as we continue to grow our relationship."
"I don't want to make mistakes."
"Oh, Mackenzie, mistakes are a part of life,
and Papa works his purpose in them, too."
She was amused, and Mac couldn't help but grin back. He could see her point well enough.
"This is so different from everything I've known, Saryu. Don't get me wrong. I love what you all have given me this weekend. But I have no idea how I go back to my life. Somehow it seemed easier to live with God when I thought of him as the demanding taskmaster, or even to cope with the loneliness of the great sadness."
"You think so?
Really? At least then I seemed to have things under control."
"Seemed is the right word.
What did it get you?"
"The great sadness and more pain than you could bear, pain that spilled over even on those you care for the most."
"According to Papa, that's because I'm scared of emotions."
"I thought that little interchange was hilarious."
"I am afraid of emotions." Mac was a bit perturbed that she seemed to make light of it. I don't like how they feel. I've hurt others with them, and I can't trust them at all. Did you create all of them, or only the good ones?
Mackenzie. Saryu seemed to rise up into the air. He still had a difficult time looking right at her, but with the late afternoon sun reflecting off the water, it was even worse.
Emotions are the colors of the soul. They are spectacular and incredible. When you don't feel, the world becomes dull and colorless. Just think how the great sadness reduced the range of color in your life down to monotones and flat grays and blacks. So help me understand them.
Not much to understand, actually. They just are. They are neither bad nor good. They just exist.
Here is something that will help you sort this out in your mind, Mackenzie.
Paradigms power perception, and perceptions power emotions. Most emotions are responses to perception, what you think is true about a given situation. If your perception is false, then your emotional response to it will be false too. So check your perceptions, and beyond that, check the truthfulness of your paradigms, what you believe. Just because you believe something firmly doesn't make it true. Be willing to re-examine what you believe. The more you live in the truth, the more your emotions will help you see clearly. But even then, you don't want to trust them more than me.
Mac allowed his oar to turn in his hands as he let it play in the water's movements.
It feels like living out of relationship, you know, trusting and talking to you, is a bit more complicated than just following rules.
What rules are those, Mackenzie?
You know, all the things the scripture tells us we should do.
Okay, and what might those be?
You know, about doing good things and avoiding evil, being kind to the poor, reading your Bible, praying, and going to church, things like that.
I see. And how is that working for you?
Well, I've never done it very well. I have moments that aren't too bad, but there's always something I'm struggling with or feeling guilty about. I just figured I needed to try harder, but I find it difficult to sustain that motivation.
Mackenzie, the Bible doesn't teach you to follow rules. It is a picture of Jesus. While words may tell you what God is like, and even what he may want from you, you cannot do any of it on your own. Life and living is in him and in no other. My goodness, you didn't think you could live the righteousness of God on your own, did you?
Well, I thought so, sort of. But you got to admit, rules and principles are simpler than relationships.
It is true that relationships are a whole lot messier than rules. But rules will never give you answers to the deep questions of the heart, and they will never love you.
Dipping his hand in the water, he played, watching the patterns his movements made.
I'm realizing how few answers I have to anything. You know, you've turned me upside down or inside out or something.
Mackenzie, religion is about having the right answers. And some of their answers are right. But I am about the process that takes you to the living answer. And once you get to him, he will change you from the inside.
There are a lot of smart people who are able to say a lot of right things from their brain because they have been told what the right answers are, but they don't know me at all. So really, how can their answers be right, even if they are right, if you understand my drift?
She smiled at her pun.
So even though they might be right, they are still wrong.
I understand what you're saying. I did that for years after seminary. I had the right answers, sometimes, but I didn't know you. This weekend, sharing life with you has been far more illuminating than any of those answers.
They continued to move lazily with a current.
So, will I see you again?
Of course. You might see me in a piece of art, or music, or silence, or through people, or in creation, or in your joy and sorrow. My ability to communicate is limitless, living and transforming, and it will always be tuned to Papa's goodness and love. And you will hear and see me in the Bible in fresh ways. Just don't look for rules and principles. Look for relationship, a way of coming to be with us.
It still won't be the same as having you sit on the bow of my boat.
No, it will be far better than you've yet known, Mackenzie. And when you finally sleep in this world, we'll have an eternity together, face to face.
And then she was gone. Although he knew that she was not really.
So please, help me live in the truth. Maybe that counts as prayer.
When Mac entered the cabin, he saw that Jesus and Sarayu were already there and seated around the table. Papa was busy as usual bringing platters of wonderful-smelling dishes, again, only a few that Mac recognized, and even those he had to look at twice to make sure they were something he was familiar with. Conspicuously absent were any greens. He headed for the bathroom to clean up, and when he returned, the other three had already begun to eat. He pulled up the fourth chair and sat down. "You don't really have to eat, do you?" He began to ladle something into his bowl that resembled a thin seafood soup with squid and fish and other more ambiguous delicacies.
"We don't have to do anything."
"Then why do you eat?"
"To be with you, honey. You need to eat, so what better excuse to be together?"
"Anyway, we all like to cook, and I enjoy food a lot. Nothing like a little shumai, ugali, nipla, or kori bananji to make your taste buds happy. Follow that with some sticky toffee pudding or a tiramisu and hot tea. Yum. Doesn't get any better than that." Everyone laughed and then busily resumed passing platters and helping themselves. As Mac ate, he listened to the banter between the three. They talked and laughed like old friends who knew one another intimately. As he thought about it, that was assuredly more true for his hosts than anyone inside or outside creation. He was envious of the carefree but respectful conversation, and wondered what it would take to share that with Nan and maybe even with some friends. Again, Mac was struck by the wonder and sheer absurdity of the moment. His mind wandered through the incredible conversations that had involved him during the previous 24 hours. Wow! He had only been here one day? And what was he supposed to do with all this when he got back home? He knew that he would tell Nan everything. She might not believe him, and not that he would blame her. He probably wouldn't believe any of it either. As his mind picked up speed, he felt himself withdrawing from the others. None of this could be real. He closed his eyes and tried to shut out the exchanges going on around him. Suddenly, it was dead silent. He slowly opened one eye, half expecting to be waking up at home. Instead, Papa, Jesus, and Sarayu were all staring at him with silly grins plastered to their faces. He didn't even try to explain himself. He knew that they knew. Instead, he pointed to one of the dishes and asked, "Can I try some of that?" The interactions resumed, and this time he listened. But again, he felt himself withdrawing. To counteract it, he decided to ask a question. "Why do you love us humans? I suppose I..." As he spoke, he realized he hadn't formed his question very well. "I guess what I want to ask is, why do you love me, when I have nothing to offer you?"
"If you think about it, Mac, it should be very freeing to know that you can offer us nothing. At least not anything that can add or take away from who we are. That should alleviate any pressure to perform."
"And do you love your own children more when they perform well?"
"No, I see your point. But I do feel more fulfilled because they are in my life."
"Do you?"
"No. We are already fully fulfilled within ourselves. You are designed to be in community as well, made as you are in our very image. So for you to feel that way about your children, or anything that adds to you, is perfectly natural and right. Keep in mind, Mackenzie, that I am not a human being, not in my very nature, despite how we have chosen to be with you this weekend. I am truly human in Jesus, but I am a totally separate other in my nature.
You do know, well, of course you do, that I can only follow that line of thought so far, and then I get lost and my brain turns to mush."
"I understand. You cannot see in your mind's eye something that you cannot experience."
Mac thought about that for a moment.
I guess so. Whatever. See? Mush!
When the others stopped laughing, Mac continued.
You know how truly grateful I am for everything, but you've dumped a whole lot in my lap this weekend. What do I do when I get back? What do you expect of me now?
Jesus and Papa both turned to Sarayu, who had a fork full of something halfway to her mouth. She slowly put it back down onto her plate and then answered Mac's confused look.
Mac, you must forgive these two. Humans have a tendency to restructure language according to their independence and need to perform. So when I hear language abused in favor of rules over sharing life with us, it is difficult for me to remain silent.
As it must.
So what exactly did I say?
Mac, go ahead and finish your bite. We can talk as you eat.
Mac realized that he too had a fork halfway to his mouth. He gratefully took the bite as Sarayu began to speak. As she did, she seemed to lift off her chair and shimmer with a dance of subtle hues and shades, and the room was faintly filling with an array of aromas, incense-like and heady.
Let me answer that by asking you a question. Why do you think we came up with the Ten Commandments?
Again, Mac had his fork halfway to his mouth, but took the bite anyway, while he thought of how to answer Sarayu.
I suppose at least I have been taught that it's a set of rules that you expected humans to obey in order to live righteously in your good graces.
If that were true, which it is not,
then how many do you think lived righteously enough to enter our good graces?
Not very many, if people are like me.
Actually, only one succeeded.
Jesus.
He not only obeyed the letter of the law, but fulfilled the spirit of it completely. But understand this, Mackenzie, to do that, he had to rest fully and dependently upon me.
Then why did you give us those commandments?
Actually, we wanted you to give up trying to be righteous on your own. It was a mirror to reveal just how filthy your face gets when you live independently. But as I'm sure you know, there are many who think they are made righteous by following the rules.
But can you clean your face with the same mirror that shows you how dirty you are? There is no mercy or grace in rules, not even for one mistake. That's why Jesus fulfilled all of it for you, so that it no longer has jurisdiction over you, and the law that once contained impossible demands, thou shalt not, actually becomes a promise we fulfill in you.
She was on a roll now, her countenance billowing and moving.
But keep in mind that if you live your life alone and independently, the promise is empty. Jesus laid the demand of the law to rest. It no longer has any power to accuse or command. Jesus is both the promise and its fulfillment.
Are you saying I don't have to follow the rules?
Mac had now completely stopped eating and was concentrating on the conversation.
Yes. In Jesus, you are not under any law. All things are lawful.
You can't be serious. You're messing with me again.
Child, you ain't heard nothing yet.
Mackenzie, those who are afraid of freedom are those who cannot trust us to live in them. Trying to keep the law is actually a declaration of independence, a way of keeping control.
Is that why we like the law so much, to give us some control?
It is much worse than that. It grants you the power to judge others and feel superior to them.
You believe you are living to a higher standard than those you judge.
Enforcing rules, especially in its more subtle expressions like responsibility and expectation, is a vain attempt to create certainty out of uncertainty. And contrary to what you might think, I have a great fondness for uncertainty. Rules cannot bring freedom. They only have the power to accuse.
Whoa. Mac suddenly realized what Sarayu had said.
Are you telling me that responsibility and expectation are just another form of rules we are no longer under? Did I hear you right?
Yep. Now we're in it. Sarayu, he is all yours.
Mac ignored Papa, choosing instead to concentrate on Sarayu, which was no easy task.
Sarayu smiled at Papa and then back at Mac.
Mackenzie,
I will take a verb over a noun any time.
She stopped and waited. Mac wasn't at all sure about what he was supposed to understand by her cryptic remark, and said the only thing that came to mind.
Huh?
She opened her hands to include Jesus and Papa.
I am a verb. I am that I am. I will be who I will be. I am a verb. I am alive, dynamic, ever acting and moving. I am a being verb.
Mac still felt like he had a blank stare on his face. He understood the words she was saying, but it just wasn't connecting yet.
And as my very essence is a verb, I am more attuned to verbs than nouns. Verbs such as confessing, repenting, living, loving, responding, growing, reaping, changing, sowing, running, dancing, singing, and on and on. Humans, on the other hand, have a knack for taking a verb that is alive and full of grace and turning it into a dead noun or principle that reeks of rules. Something growing and alive dies. Nouns exist because there is a created universe and physical reality, but if the universe is only a mass of nouns, it is dead. Unless I am, there are no verbs, and verbs are what makes the universe alive.
Mac was still struggling, although a glimmer of light seemed to begin to shine into his mind.
And this means what exactly?
Sarayu seemed unperturbed by his lack of understanding.
For something to move from death to life, you must introduce something living and moving into the mix. To move from something that is only a noun to something dynamic and unpredictable, to something living and present tense, is to move from law to grace. May I give you a couple examples?
Please do. I'm all ears. Jesus chuckled, and Max scowled at him before turning back to Sarayu. The faintest shadow of a smile crossed her face as she resumed.
Then let's use your two words, responsibility and expectation. Before your words became nouns, they were first my words, nouns with movement and experience buried inside of them, the ability to respond and expectancy. My words are alive and dynamic, full of life and possibility. Yours are dead, full of law and fear and judgment. That is why you won't find the word responsibility in the scriptures.
Mac grimaced, beginning to see where this was going.
Oh, boy, we sure seem to use it a lot. Religion must use law to empower itself and control the people who they need in order to survive. I give you an ability to respond, and your response is to be free to love and serve in every situation, and therefore each moment is different and unique and wonderful. Because I am your ability to respond, I have to be present in you. If I simply gave you a responsibility, I would not have to be with you at all. It would now be a task to perform, an obligation to be met, something to fail. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Let's use the example of friendship and how removing the element of life from a noun can drastically alter a relationship. Mac, if you and I are friends, there is an expectancy that exists within our relationship. When we see each other or are apart, there is expectancy of being together, of laughing and talking. That expectancy has no concrete definition. It is alive and dynamic, and everything that emerges from our being together is a unique gift shared by no one else. But what happens if I change that expectancy to an expectation, spoken or unspoken? Suddenly, law has entered into our relationship. You are now expected to perform in a way that meets my expectations. Our living friendship rapidly deteriorates into a dead thing with rules and requirements. It is no longer about you and me, but about what friends are supposed to do, or the responsibilities of a good friend.
Or the responsibilities of a husband, or a father, or employee, or whatever.
I get the picture. I would much rather live in expectancy,
as I do.
But if you didn't have expectations and responsibilities, wouldn't everything just fall apart?
Only if you are of the world, apart from me and under the law.
Responsibilities and expectations are the basis of guilt and shame and judgment, and they provide the essential framework that promotes performance as the basis for identity and value. You know well what it is like not to live up to someone's expectations.
Boy, do I. It's not my idea of a good time.
He paused briefly, a new thought flashing through his mind.
Are you saying you have no expectations of me?
Honey, I've never placed an expectation on you or anyone else. The idea behind expectations requires that someone does not know the future or outcome and is trying to control behavior to get the desired result. Humans try to control behavior, largely through expectations.
I know you and everything about you.
Why would I have an expectation other than what I already know? That would be foolish. And beyond that, because I have no expectations, you never disappoint me.
Mac was trying hard to digest this.
What? You've never been disappointed in me?
Never. What I do have is a constant and living expectancy in our relationship, and I give you an ability to respond to any situation and circumstance in which you find yourself. To the degree that you resort to expectations and responsibilities, to that degree you neither know me nor trust me.
And to that degree, you will live in fear.
But don't you want us to set priorities? You know, God first, then whatever, followed by whatever. The trouble with living by priorities is that it sees everything as a hierarchy, a pyramid, and you and I have already had that discussion. If you put God at the top, what does that really mean, and how much is enough? How much time do you give me before you can go on about the rest of your day, the part that interests you so much more?
You see, Mackenzie, I don't just want a piece of you and a piece of your life. Even if you were able, which you are not, to give me the biggest piece, that is not what I want. I want all of you and all of every part of you in your day.
Mac, I don't want to be first among a list of values. I want to be at the center of everything. When I live in you, then together we can live through everything that happens to you. Rather than a pyramid, I want to be the center of a mobile, where everything in your life, your friends, family, occupation, thoughts, activities, is connected to me but moves with the wind in and out and back and forth in an incredible dance of being.
And I am the wind.
She smiled hugely and bowed. There was a silence while Mac collected himself. He'd been gripping the edge of the table with both hands as if to hold on to something tangible in the face of such an onslaught of ideas and images.
Papa got up from her chair. Well, enough of all this. Time for some fun. You all go ahead while I put away the stuff that'll spoil. I'll take care of the dishes later.
What about devotion?
Nothing is a ritual, Mac. So tonight, we are doing something different.
You are going to enjoy this.
As Mac stood up and turned to follow Jesus to the back door, he felt a hand on his shoulder and turned around. Sarayu was standing close, looking at him intently.
Mackenzie, if you would allow me, I would like to give you a gift for this evening. May I touch your eyes and heal them just for tonight?
Mac was surprised.
I see well enough, don't I?
Actually, you see very little, even though for a human you see fairly well. But just for tonight, I would love you to see a bit of what we see.
Then, by all means, please touch my eyes and more if you choose.
As she reached her hands toward him, Mac closed his eyes and leaned forward. Her touch was like ice, unexpected and exhilarating. A delicious shiver went through him, and he reached up to hold her hands to his face.
There was nothing there,
so he slowly began to open his eyes. A Festival of Friends. You can kiss your family and friends goodbye and put miles between you, but at the same time, you carry them with you in your heart, your mind, your stomach, because you do not just live in a world, but a world lives in you. Frederick Buechner. When Mac opened his eyes, he had to immediately shield them from a blinding light that overwhelmed him. Then he heard something.
You will find it very difficult to look at me directly, or at Papa. But as your mind becomes accustomed to the changes, it will be easier.
He was standing right where he had closed his eyes, but the shack was gone as well as the dock and shop. Instead, he was outside, perched on the top of a small hill under a brilliant but moonless night sky. He could see that the stars were in motion, not hurriedly, but smoothly and with precision, as if they were grand celestial conductors coordinating their movements. Occasionally, as if on cue, comets and meteor showers would tumble through the starry ranks, adding variation to the flowing dance. Then Mac saw some of the stars grow and change color, as if they were turning nova or white dwarf. It was as if time itself had become dynamic and volatile, adding to the seeming chaotic but precisely managed heavenly display. He turned back to Sarayu, who still stood next to him. Although she was still difficult to look at directly, he could now make out symmetry and colors embedded within patterns, as if miniature diamonds, rubies, and sapphires of all colors had been sewn into a garment of light, which moved first in waves and then scattered as particulate.
"It is all so incredibly beautiful," he whispered, surrounded as he was by such a holy and majestic sight. "Truly. Now, Mackenzie, look around."
He did, and gasped. Even in the darkness of the night, everything had clarity and shone with halos of light in various hues and shades of color. The forest was itself afire with light and color, yet each tree was distinctly visible, each branch, each leaf. Birds and bats created a trail of colored fire as they flew or chased each other. He could even see that in the distance an army of creation was in attendance. Deer, bear, mountain sheep, and majestic elk near the edges of the forest, an otter and beaver in the lake, each shining in its own colors and blaze. Myriads of little creatures scampered and darted everywhere, each alive within its own glory. In a rush of peach and plum and currant flames, an osprey dove toward the surface of the lake, but pulled up at the last instant to skim across its surface, sparks from its wings falling like snow into the waters as it passed. Behind it, a large rainbow-clothed lake trout burst through the surface as if to taunt a passing hunter, and then dropped back in the midst of a splash of colors. Mac felt larger than life, as if he were able to be present wherever he looked. Two bear cubs playing near the feet of their mother caught his eye, ochre, mint, and hazel, tumbling as they rolled, and laughed in their native tongue. From where he stood, Mac felt that he could reach out and touch them, and without thought stretched out his arm. He drew it back, startled as he realized that he too was ablaze. He looked at his hands, wonderfully crafted and clearly visible inside the cascading colors of light that seemed to glove them. He examined the rest of his body to find that light and color robed him completely, a clothing of purity that allowed him both freedom and propriety. Mac realized also that he felt no pain, not even in his usually aching joints. In fact, he had never felt this well, this whole. His head was clear, and he breathed deeply the scents and aromas of the night and of the sleeping flowers in the garden, many of which had begun to awaken to this celebration. Delirious and delicious joy welled up inside of him, and he jumped, floating slowly up into the air, then returned gently to the ground. So similar, he thought, to dream flying. And then Mac saw the lights. Single moving points emerging from the forest, converging upon the meadow below where he and Sarayu stood. He could see them now high up on the surrounding mountains, appearing and disappearing as they made their way toward them, down unseen paths and trails. They broke into the meadow, an army of children. There were no candles. They themselves were lights, and within their own radiance, each was dressed in distinctive garbs that Mac imagined represented every tribe and tongue. Although he could only identify a few, it didn't matter. These were the children of the earth, Papa's children. They entered with quiet dignity and grace, faces full of contentment and peace, young ones holding the hands of even younger ones. For a moment, Mac wondered if Missy might be there, and although he looked for a minute, he gave up. He settled within himself that if she were, and if she wanted to run to him, she would. The children had now formed a huge circle within the meadow, with a path left open from near where Mac stood into the very center. Little bursts of fire and light, like a stadium of slow-popping flashbulbs, ignited when the children would giggle or whisper. Even though Mac had no idea what was going on, they obviously did, and the anticipation was almost too much for them. Emerging into the clearing behind them and forming another circle of larger lights stood those whom Mac presumed were adults, like himself, colorfully brilliant and yet subdued. Suddenly, Mac's attention was caught by an unusual motion. It appeared that one of the light beings in the outer circle was having some difficulty. Flashes and spears of violet and ivory would arch briefly into the night in their direction. As these retreated, they were replaced by orchid, gold, and flaming vermilion, burning and brilliant sprays of radiance that burst out again toward them, flaming against the immediate darkness, only to subside and return to their source. Sarayu chuckled. "What's going on? There is a man here who is having some difficulty keeping in what he is feeling." Whoever was struggling could not contain himself and was agitating some of the others nearby. The ripple effect was clearly visible as the flashing light extended into the surrounding ring of children. Those closest to the instigator seemed to be responding as color and light flowed from them toward him. The combinations that emerged from each were unique and seemed to Mac to contain a distinctive response to the one causing the commotion. "I still don't understand." "Mackenzie, the pattern of color and light is unique to each person. No two are alike, and no pattern is ever the same twice. Here we are able to see each other truly, and part of seeing means that individual personality and emotion is visible in color and light."
"This is incredible. Then why are the children's colors mostly white?"
"As you near them, you will see that they have many individual colors that have merged into white, which contains all. As they mature and grow to become who they really are, the colors they exhibit will become more distinctive, and unique hues and shades will emerge."
"Incredible,"
was all Mac could think to say, and he looked more intently. He now noticed that behind the circle of adults, others had emerged, spaced equally around the entire perimeter. They were taller flames, seeming to blow with the wind currents, and were a similar sapphire and aqua blue, with unique bits of other colors embedded in each one. Sarayu answered before Mac could ask,
"Angels, servants and watchers."
"Incredible."
"There is more, Mackenzie, and this will help you understand the problem this particular one is having." She pointed in the direction of the ongoing commotion. Even to Mac, it was obvious that the man, whomever he was, continued to have difficulty. Sudden and abrupt spears of light and color at times shot out even farther toward them.
"We are not only able to see the uniqueness of one another in color and light, but we are able to respond through the same medium. But this response is very difficult to control, and it is usually not intended to be restrained, as this one is attempting. It is most natural to let its expression just be."
"I don't understand. Are you saying that we can respond to one another in colors?"
"Yes."
Sarayu nodded, or at least that's what Mac thought she did.
"Each relationship between two persons is absolutely unique. That is why you cannot love two people the same. It simply is not possible. You love each person differently because of who they are and the uniqueness that they draw out of you. And the more you know another, the richer the colors of that relationship."
Mac was listening, but still watching the display before them.
"Perhaps the best way you can understand is for me to give you a quick illustration. Suppose, Mac, that you are hanging out with a friend at your local coffee shop. You are focused on your companion, and if you had eyes to see, the two of you would be enveloped in an array of colors and light, which mark not only your uniqueness as individuals, but also the uniqueness of the relationship between you and the emotions you'd be experiencing in that moment."
"But," Mac began to ask, only to be cut off.
"But suppose that another person whom you love enters the coffee shop, and although you are wrapped in the conversation with your first friend, you notice this other's entry. Again, if you had eyes to see the greater reality, here's what you would witness. As you continued your current conversation, a unique combination of color and light would leave you and wrap itself around the one who had just entered, representing you in another form of loving and greeting that one. And one more thing, Mackenzie. It is not only visual, but sensual as well. You can feel, smell, and even taste that uniqueness."
"I love that. But except for that one over there," he pointed in the direction of the agitated lights among the adults, "how are they all so calm? I would think there would be color everywhere. Don't they know each other?"
"They know one another very well, most of them. But they are here for a celebration that is not about them, nor about their relationships with one another, at least not directly. They are waiting."
"For what?"
"You will see very soon."
It was obvious that she was not about to say any more on the matter. Mac's attention had returned to the troublemaker.
"So then why is that one having so much difficulty, and why does he seem focused on us?"
"Mackenzie, he is not focused on us. He is focused on you."
"What? The one having so much trouble containing himself, that one is your father."
A wave of emotions, a mixture of angers and longings, washed over Mac, and as if on cue, his father's colors burst from across the meadow and enveloped him. He was lost in a wash of ruby and vermilion, magenta and violet, as the light and color whirled around and embraced him. And somehow, in the middle of the exploding storm, he found himself running across the meadow to find his father, running toward the source of the colors and emotions. He was a little boy wanting his daddy, and for the first time, he was not afraid. He was running, not caring for anything but the object of his heart, and he found him. His father was on his knees, awash in light, tears sparkling like a waterfall of diamonds and jewels into the hands that covered his face.
"Daddy!"
Mac threw himself onto the man who could not even look at his son. In the howl of wind and flame, Mac took his father's face in his two hands, forcing his dad to look him in the face so he could stammer the words he had always wanted to say.
"Daddy, I'm so sorry. Daddy, I love you."
The light of his words seemed to blast darkness out of his father's colors, turning them blood red. They exchanged sobbing words of confession and forgiveness as a love greater than either one healed them. Finally, they were able to stand together, a father holding his son as he had never been able to before. It was then that Mac noticed the swell of a song that washed over them both as it penetrated the holy place where he stood with his father. With arms around each other, they listened, unable to speak through the tears, to the song of reconciliation that lit the night sky. An arching fountain of brilliant color began among the children, especially those who had suffered the greatest, and then rippled as if passed from one to the next by the wind, until the entire field was flooded with light and song. Mac somehow knew that this was not a time for conversation, and that his time with his father was quickly passing. He sensed that by some mystery this was as much for his dad as it was for him. As for Mac, the new lightness he felt was euphoric. Kissing his father on the lips, he turned and made his way back to the small hill where Sarayu stood waiting for him. As he passed through the ranks of children, He could feel their touches and colors quickly embrace him and fall away. Somehow he was already known and loved here. When he reached Sarayu, she embraced him as well, and he let her just hold him as he continued to cry. When he regained some semblance of coherence, he turned to look back at the meadow, the lake, and night sky. A hush descended. The anticipation was palpable. Suddenly to their right, from out of the darkness, emerged Jesus, and pandemonium broke out. He was dressed in a simple, brilliant white garment, and wore on his head a simple gold crown, but he was every inch the king of the universe. He walked the path that opened before him into the center of all creation, the man who is God and the God who is man. Light and color danced and wove a tapestry of love for him to step on. Some were crying out words of love, while others simply stood with hands lifted up. Many of those whose colors were the richest and deepest were lying flat on their faces. Everything that had a breath sang out a song of unending love and thankfulness. Tonight, the universe was as it was intended. As Jesus reached the center, he paused to look around. His gaze stopped on Mac, standing on the small hill at the outer edge, and he heard Jesus whisper in his ear, "Mac, I am especially fond of you." That was all Mac could bear as he slumped to the ground, dissolving into a wash of joyful tears. He couldn't move, gripped as he was in Jesus' embrace of love and tenderness. He then heard Jesus say clearly and loudly, but oh, so gently and invitingly, "Come." And they did, the children first, and then the adults, each in turn for as long as they needed, to laugh and talk and embrace and sing with their Jesus. Time seemed to have completely stopped as the celestial dance and display continued, and each in turn then left, until none remained except the burning blue sentinels and the animals. Even these Jesus walked among, calling each by name, until they and their young turned to make their way back to dens and nests and bedding pastures. Mac stood motionless, trying to absorb this experience that was beyond his ability to capture. "I had no idea," he whispered, shaking his head and gazing into the distance. "Unbelievable." Sarayu laughed a shower of colors. "Just imagine, Mackenzie, if I had touched not only your eyes, but also your tongue and nose and ears." Finally, they were alone once more. The wild, haunting cry of a loon echoing across the lake seemed to signal the end of the celebration, and the sentinels vanished in unison. The only sounds remaining were a chorus of crickets and frogs resuming their own songs of worship from out of the water's edge and surrounding meadows. Without a word, the three turned and walked back toward the shack that had again become visible to Mac. Like a curtain being drawn across his eyes, he was suddenly blind again, his vision returning to normal. He felt a loss and a longing and even a little sad, until Jesus came alongside and took his hand, squeezing it to let Mac know that everything was as it should be. A Morning of Sorrows. An infinite God can give all of himself to each of his children. He does not distribute himself that each may have a part, but to each one he gives all of himself as fully as if there were no others. A. W. Tozer. It seemed that he had only just entered a deep sleep of dreamless rest when Mac felt a hand shaking him awake.
"Mac, wake up. It's time for us to go."
The voice was familiar but deeper, as if she had just woken from sleep herself.
What time is it?"
He tried to figure out where he was and what he was doing.
"It's time to go."
Although he didn't think that answered what he had been asking, he climbed out of the bed grumbling and fumbling until he found the lamp switch and snapped it on. It was blinding after the pitch dark, and it took another moment until he could pry one eye open and squint up at his early morning visitor. The man standing next to him looked a bit like Papa. Dignified, older and wiry, and taller than Mac. He had silver-white hair pulled back into a ponytail, matched by a gray-splashed mustache and goatee. Plaid shirt with sleeves rolled up, jeans and hiking boots completed the outfit of someone ready to hit the trail.
Papa?
Yes, son.
You're still messing with me, aren't you?
Always. He answered Mac's next question before it was asked. This morning you're gonna need a father. Come on now, let's get going. I have everything you need on the chair and table at the end of your bed. I'll meet you out in the kitchen where you can grab a bite to eat before we head out.
Mac nodded. He didn't bother to ask where they might be heading out to. If Papa had wanted him to know, he would have told him. He quickly dressed into perfectly fitting clothes similar to what Papa was wearing and donned a pair of hiking boots. After a quick stop in the bathroom to freshen up, he walked into the kitchen. Jesus and Papa stood by the counter, looking a lot more rested than Mac felt. He was about to speak when Sarayu entered through the back door with a large, rolled-up pack. It looked like an elongated sleeping bag, bound tightly with a strap hooked to each end so it could be easily carried. She handed it to Mac, and he could immediately smell a wonderful mixture of scents arising from the bundle. It was a blend of aromatic herbs and flowers that he thought he recognized. He could smell cinnamon and mint, along with salts and fruits. "This is a gift for later. Papa will show you how to use it." She smiled and hugged him. Or that was the only way he could describe it. It was just so hard to tell with her.
"You may carry it. You picked those with Sarayu yesterday."
"My gift will wait here until you return," smiled Jesus. The two left out the back and